Hi there. Welcome to Sound Healing Radio. My name's David Gibson, and our guest today is Richard Feather Anderson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, David.
Welcome. As usual, we always start with an intention. What is the intention you'd like to hold for us to hold today?
Harmony, a very specific kind of harmony. Let's set an intention to explore how to learn how to create harmony in our physical environments and in our sonic environments and all the vibrations around us. That sort of pulls together my background in architecture and community healing ritual kind of stuff.
Perfect. Cool. Before we get started, though, I want to tell people a few things that are happening at the school. We've got the Sound Healing Certificate Program and Associate Degree starting here at the Institute on May 20th again. And that's the for the certificate program, that's the three-month program, which is three nights a week and some weekends. But we also have the same program as a summer intensive. So if you're not nearby, it's perfect for people to come in and do classes 10 to 9:30 every day for 2 weeks. And as I always say, we haven't killed off anybody yet. You know, it's very immersive. People come out totally transformed. And we've got a two-week version starting June 9th to the 22nd, and then a second 2 weeks in August 4th to the 16th. And you can do just one or the other, or you could do both to get the whole certificate program. You can also do the online classes to complete the certificate program if you only wanted to do one. We have the online classes starting actually this week. You could start on Tuesday or the following Tuesday. We start about every 2 or 3 weeks when we have a new instructor, and we do the whole certificate and associate degree online. Works really well. We've got, the way I think of it is about 60% of the classes or more are exactly the same. If you're doing a lecture or demonstration, there's no difference at all. In fact, it's really quite cool. There's about 20% that's better if you do it here, and those are the ones we do at the intensive. And then there's a small percentage that we don't do online, like sound and movement and such as well. We also have the audio recording production program starting May 20th as well. We do have an intensive this summer, which we've never done before, which is just doubling up on the classes per week. And that goes from June 23rd to August 3rd. So you can actually do the sound healing intensive and in between do the audio intensive. I have some people coming from England that are going to be doing that. And that's learning how to do audio production with software and create recordings and productions and mixes that affect people deeper and more, just deeper physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. We also have that class online starting a week from Tuesday, April 9th, and it works really well online. You can see our screen on the computer, and we've got it rigged so that the Pro Tools goes right through the program, so you can hear what I'm mixing in real time while you're seeing it. So that's happening as well. Now, the other thing, we have a lot of events coming up. Looks like we're just scheduling a class this weekend, coming weekend, with a guy named Amit, who is here from Israel, amazing voice sound healer. And so you can check on our website or email us or call us for information about that. But the big thing we have happening is the sound healing concert, the Sound of Love concert. And that's on May 5th at an amazing temple. It's Congregation Cherith. And in fact, it was funny because I was looking for a place and I asked Richard, since Richard does the sacred geometry, I said, what's a cool place to do a place at? And he mentioned this place, and oh my God, you walk in and it's like, whoa. It's like here in San Francisco, one of the coolest places is Grace Cathedral. I like this place better even. I mean, Grace is pretty cool, but this is really amazing also. And so that's May 5th from 5:30 to 8:30. And the cool thing is we've got Tina Malia is going to be singing with us. Tina is amazing. She's been selling out concerts. In fact, she's singing tonight. She's doing a concert in about an hour in Marin County, which is her new release party, but she's going to be with us on May 5th. Also, Stephen Halpern will be there, and a lot of our instructors, a lot of our best students from over the years, amazing, amazing singers, including this guy, Emmanuel. Oh, my God. Emmanuel, he just called recently, and Emmanuel said that he's worked on 60 people with cancer in the last year, and only five of them still have cancer. This guy has the most amazing voice, and I've been around. I've heard a lot of people over the years with amazing voices. This guy's voice is from another dimension. He did a healing on me, actually, over the phone with his voice. Oh, my God. It's like cruising through the whole body. He's a total medical intuitive besides having an amazing voice. He'll be at the concert as well. So also, he'll be doing treatments the day before the concert and the day after here in San Francisco. So a lot happening. If you're interested in anything or want to talk, you can call me at 415-777-2486. That's 415-777-2486. Or you can email me at david@soundhealingcenter.com. Or just go to our website, soundhealingcenter.com. Also, we now have the store, the Resonant Harmony SF. You can find it on our website, though, soundhealingcenter.com. We have all kinds of cool sound healing instruments and technologies. And what's really cool is we've got all of our crystal bowls, all of the alchemical bowls, where you can click on them and play them, and play multiple bowls at once. I mean, you can spend an hour like playing with all the bowls and listening to them, and they're totally angelic, just amazing. I mean, it's just beautiful alchemical bowls with minerals and crystals embedded in the actual bowl. A lot of other instruments as well. You can check out in a lot of recordings, so check that out as well. So that's what we have happening. So Richard Feather Anderson is one of our instructors here at the Institute. He's been here for quite a while teaching sacred geometry, and Richard has been doing it since the beginning of time. I mean, I say that funny in a funny way, but the truth is, Richard has really been researching this a long time. He's got as much background as anybody in the field, and is an amazing instructor, really well organized. And what's cool about the classes, I've sat in quite a few times, is Richard not only goes through all the different aspects of sacred geometry and how geometry can be used and help us and such, but he brings in the relationship between sound and sacred geometry and discusses all the different aspects of harmonics and musical intervals in relation to geometry, so you can see the connection between the two. But the most amazing thing that he does in such an amazing way, is he brings in not only the history, but the whole aspect of how sacred geometry relates to consciousness as a whole. So he really brings in the whole, so it's not just like a geometry class. It's like a class you really get high in as well. Because, you know, it really makes you think and really see the world from a whole higher perspective as to what higher consciousness is. Is that a good description?
That's a fabulous description. Hire you as a marketing agent.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's just, every time after the classes, people are just like, whoa. And I've had people that have gone into the class and said, oh, I knew nothing about sacred geometry. I could care less. And they come out and like, whoa, this is so amazing. It's so cool. Because, you know, it's really just another form of vibration. And in vibration, we have frequencies, but we all have also have the relationship between frequencies, and it all is exactly the same in geometry. But let me start with the question that everybody asks over and over and over and over. Okay, why is it we call it sacred geometry? Sacred geometry.
Well, that's a great place to start, David, because and it also ties in with when you were talking about the students' reactions from the journey they take with me. The geometry that most people are familiar with that we had in, I guess most people have in 10th grade or something, is a math class. And a lot of the students come into my class and say, oh, I'm not sure about this. I didn't do good at math. I'm really, you know, they're expressing one form of math fear or phobia or something.
It's more than a math class. What I remember is stress. It's a stress class.
Yeah, and so I kind of I often start by saying, okay, folks, the reason we call it sacred geometry is that it bears no resemblance to that class you had in 10th grade. So we're worried about the geometry part of the phrase sacred geometry. You know, don't worry, and welcome to a clinic for the healing of math distress and geometry abuse that which you unfortunately, were a victim of in our educational system. And, you know, and that sort of gets their attention. They say, oh, okay, if it's not like that, then what is it? And it says, well, it's cosmology, it's physics, it's symbolism through shapes and forms and proportions. It's a completely different world than that other geometry class, which was sort of about very abstract concepts taught with algebra, which is the most abstract, one of the most abstract branches of math to begin with. And I say, actually, you know, we're going to revisit, you know, we'll go back and I'll teach you the Pythagorean theorem the way that I think he taught it, not using algebra, which of course hadn't been invented in his time, but using geometry. So there's a way, you know, and then I say Pythagoras taught often using marbles in a sandbox, you know. So I'm going to teach you using that way to understand his famous theorem. And, you know, and I see I'm hearing the sighs and I'm seeing the shoulders relax, and, you know, and then it starts to go into, you know, well, if that geometry that we know is not what this is about, well then, you know, what is it? And then I say, okay, well, you know, it's what, if the ancient world had the word physics, they would have called sacred geometry their physics, you know, but they didn't. They called it geometry. But it was a way, it's a way of understanding how the whole universe is put together, how it was created, and how everything continues to be created. So even the creation of matter is created because there is geometry in our universe. And a lot of the physicists, cosmologists, some of them have even said things like, as we get closer and closer to the Big Bang and try to understand how this universe was created, what we're finding is pure geometry. And of course, every time I hear that, I just, you know, I have chills. It's like, oh, yes, the scientists are coming back to the mystics and the metaphysicians and stuff. So it's as sacred geometry, we have to have a different phrase from geometry, because, you know, we're not proving theorems about angles and two lines intersecting. You know, we're talking about the intersection of two people, of relationships, because geometry is nature's way of creating relationships. So even simple things like sitting side by side to read a book to a child, you know, that's a geometrical relationship. In astrology, it's called the conjunct, or joining with, because two planets that are in the same place in the sky in relationship to Earth that are called a conjunct. An opposition is what happens when you get in an argument. You know, you get in somebody's face. I mean, just listen to the language. There's geometry being spoken there if you have ears to hear it. So I kind of start out by saying, you know, the way we're sitting in a semicircle and me up front, and, you know, it's all geometry. And so
that's
the way
that's
atoms
so cool.
of molecules and petals on a flower are arranged, that's
right.
that's geometry.
That was the huge missing part, was the fact that this is our real world. This is nature. This is within us. This is, you know, the relationship of everything around us. It's our whole world. And it's so bizarre that it was so disconnected in school, that there was no basis of our, because what you should always start with is your you know, perceptual reality. That's where we are grounded in. That's where we are. I mean, and then go from there and connect it all. And really just, it's an observation of what is real. You know?
Yeah, you know, Pythagoras, another one of his famous statements, is the one one of the ones I really love. He said, you can learn everything you need to know about the reality of your life, the universe you're living in, the world, the earth. You can learn everything you need to know just by observation of nature. And what he meant is not the way that we observe things. He's talking about, you know, I would have to add to that phrase astute observation, knowing how to see what's in front of you. And and so when Pythagoras said that, he said, we should rephrase that and say, well, if you know sacred geometry, you can learn everything you need to know about the universe by astute observation and noticing those geometrical patterns that are there in the flowers and the nautilus shell and the, you know, in your own hand and all that stuff. It will lead you directly to universal principles of how this whole reality is put together.
That's really the key, is the universal principles, because when you get to that level, I mean, first of all, I want to say, you know, after taking your class, I mean, I see everything differently. I mean, I see the window differently. I see the relationships of one side of the window to the other. I see hubcaps differently. You know, I mean, it's like not to mention flowers and everything. And the main thing, it's interesting, the main thing I notice now where I'm at in my perceptual reality is every time I notice something, I notice the amount of order versus the amount of chaos, or just, you know, chaos is, I guess, a good word. Because it seems like there's a lot of things in nature that aren't perfect mathematically, but, you know, it's like I look across the field. I mean, often I'll look across the field and I'll think, what percentage of chaos is this, and what percentage is order? I know there's perfect order as to why that group of plants are up on the hill and these are down here and that the shape of the leaves and everything, but there's so much variety. It's just so, and so that's what I see now. I'm always looking at the amount of order versus chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the more you learn about geometry, and I certainly have had this experience, and it's similar to your never seeing a hubcap the same. By the way, what David's referring to there is an exercise to do in the class for listeners. Just I show lots and lots of the images of mandalas, rose windows, flowers, all sorts of different images that have a radial symmetry to it. In other words, it's like spokes in a wheel. And I'm asking them to, you know, look at these and see if they can guess, without counting, how many spokes there are in that wheel. And then I give them some tricks for being able to recognize them. It's a pattern recognition game, which, again, is something that's not in our education system. We're not taught how to observe patterns. And that's key to what Pythagoras was talking about. If you do know geometry, you do have the ability to recognize the geometry of life, and if you have the ability to look at any circle or sphere that's divided into equal increments, you know, and see that pattern, well, then you're starting to see more of the inherent order in the universe. And so the way I think about chaos and order is that chaos is basically not seeing the whole picture. Geometry, Pythagoras defined geometry as order in space, And what I think he meant by that is being able to recognize and see and understand the inherent order to the material world, specifically in the way that objects are arranged in space, or the way parts of a flower or molecule or whatever is arranged in space. And so that exercise is basically helping people to see more of the world that is all around you and understand that there's an inherent order to everything. Nothing's created by accident. Everything arises because of sort of inner, well, the geometrical code, for instance. Plants will grow with particular proportions and ratios and symmetry patterns because it's not just following their DNA, but there's a geometrical code that goes along with the DNA code that gives each thing its sense of what it is, its sense of identity. And so really, you know, that simple exercise of being able to quickly recognize the geometry and objects around you actually is working much deeper to make a shift of consciousness where you can understand that everything is orderly. And what I've learned from all the different mystical geometry traditions I've studied is that the ultimate reason for studying it was to know thyself and to know your connection with the universe and to know that all these principles that guide the way that the skeleton, the human skeleton grows, are the same principles that are in the physics of how our solar system was put together and the relationship between the planets and their orbits and, you know, all this amazing stuff that you'd never think of as a part of the story of consciousness. Well, more and more people are thinking of it now, but, you know, so that's what I love about geometry. Just pick any piece of the study of sacred geometry. It will help you understand the world around you. It will help you understand your connection and help you see that everything is orderly, even though you may not be able to recognize the order there. It's after a while, you look at enough things and realize, oh, I didn't see it, but now I see there's an order there to the way that's working.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It really gets me thinking about the not even just understanding, but going to a higher level, what it does for you when you see this order and the way all things are connected. And my first thought, and this is kind of just brainstorming here, or just playing with it, because this is kind of the coolest part, I think, is I go to a place of complete stillness, like I'm in the mind of God, mm-hmm. that actually created all this order. That's the best way I can say it so far, but it's like really it's beyond understanding. It's beyond awe. It's almost where you become that stillness of that mind that was aware and intelligent enough to create all this order as we are.
Yeah, it's really I'm going to go off on several tangents here.
Good. I thought that would trigger a few there.
That's a big nugget there, David. Let's start with the stillness part. Sacred geometry is also a meditation practice. And I always give students some sort of experience of that, usually drawing with compass. And their energy starts to shift. And it's like, you know, you can just feel the energy in the room go from the intellectual exploration and all that beta activity in the brain, and you can just feel how they're shifting into alpha and deeper, you know, and everybody gets calm. You know, it'd be really interesting, now thinking of brainstorming, it'd be really interesting to take pictures of people's eyes before doing those exercises and see if the pupils don't dilate, because that often happens going into alpha state. But anyway, I notice the students really relax. They get in a very quiet, calmer place. And as we're drawing, then they start to have these aha moments of, oh my goodness, look at that. You know, we're drawing a bunch of overlapping circles or flower life mandala or something. And I, as they're drawing, I'm giving them directions, technical directions about how to draw, but I'm also filling in with the symbolism of what we just did, you know. That circle we call the source, and then this second circle is reflected out of the source, so we call it the reflection or the sun and the moon. And you know, I'm kind of going on, and they're starting to get this sense of, you know, it's like the drawing. The mandala is communicating something to them directly from the mind of the one that created all this stuff. And so, what fascinates me is that all of the creation stories start with the statement of, in the stillness,
wow,
or in the void, or in the silence, or in the no thing, the nothingness. You know, there was nothing, there was stillness, there was quiet. That's a huge, and then out of that, you know, comes a breath or comes a sound or, you know, something that creates the universe. And that's a huge clue to us about where to go to connect. You know, go to stillness to connect with the one. And then the other tangent I could go off here is you said the mind of God. In the sacred geometry language, particularly in the Islamic sacred art tradition, you know, Allah means one, and that is represented by a circle or a sphere, which is the ultimate symbol of oneness or unified consciousness or universal consciousness or single-pointed consciousness, you know, totally focused, no distractions, no multitasking, just focused on one thing at a time, totally present in the here and now. That's all represented by a circle or a sphere in terms of consciousness within us. So in the stillness, in the mind of the one, there is this inner knowing, and that goes back to the geometry code of know thyself. You know, this practice, the primary purpose was not to understand the physics of the universe, but the physics of the human soul, and to understand who we are, what we're made of, what are, you know, it's just, that fascinates me, that there's this incredible spectrum of what you can do with this.
It's interesting because when, as you, it's really all, not all, but a lot of it's about harmony. I guess one thing I remember a few years ago after having had the classes, I went camping. And I looked up at the stars, and you know, normally you look at the stars and it seems like a cacophony up there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I just got this major rush of energy that, oh my God, what incredible order up there. And not only up there, but that same order that's up there is within every cell of my body. I mean, within every part of my, it's like the whole planet, everything is unbelievable order. And something about that knowingness of order and harmony just makes you feel good.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think the ultimate, You know, there, a lot of philosophers have written about, you know, what is the purpose of human life or what is the meaning of human life. And I think the ultimate thing is to become one with it all. And, of course, that is a state of harmony. And so every little tidbit of guidance and help and insights we can get out of things like sacred geometry, you know, helps us understand harmony and resonance and all these words that we just kind of throw around. But what I love is that this gives us a way of technically understanding how that works, you know, and of course it's perfect in sound healing where you can, you know, then, you know, we've got precise frequencies and numbers you can put on it and quantify it, and you know, you can make two sounds at a different relationship of frequencies, an octave or perfect fifth or whatever, you know, and you can calculate that stuff out. And so there's that preciseness on that side, and then there's the experience of listening to sounds or music and having your heart open or having tears come to your eye because the way that the music moved you, and you don't need to understand anything about the science or the technical or the numbers or the mathematical ratios in the music or anything. It just overwhelms you. And you know, and so I think the ultimate thing is really about, I would agree, it's about harmony, but I would take it another step. It's like, mm-hmm. I think we've got this something embedded in human consciousness for us to seek to be one with everything and to be in harmony with everything. But it seems to me the reason for that is to make a connection to all forms of life, and to all beings. And because when you make a connection and sort of heal that Western rift of the idea that we're separate, that we're individuals and we're separate from everything, and to heal that and come into the sense of, well, we're one with everything. And because the next thing that happens, I think, after that, is that when you are feeling the connection, you're now wanting, you care about the thing that you're connected with, you know, and you only have to go into love relationships or family relationships or, you know, any relationship, just, you know, that you really care about someone, that's because you're really connected to that person. You have an intimate connection or an intimate bond or something. And so for me, I mean, some of this started with my architectural training and my searching for how can we create new physical environments, new towns and cities that people care about so much that you don't have to have a public works department that goes and picks up the litter. You know, when you go to a lot of the small villages in Europe, they don't have people picking up the litter because nobody's dropping mm-hmm. stuff onto the ground because they care about the place.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I got fascinated by what, and I'm still following that question, you know, what is it about some places that the sense that you have a strong connection, the place has a sense of place, and then you have a sense of connection to it, and you feel this real sense of community there, you know. So I've been, that's a whole other story, but I've been trying.
You know, it seems like the first thing that comes to mind is it seems like the complexity of what, of the structure or the layout is such that it seems like there's some type of higher mind involved. And when you get that sense of like, oh my God, then there's a sense of reverence that comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the big influences for me in architecture school was Christopher Alexander, who was one of the heads of the school at UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And he, one of his early books really made an impression on me. And what he was talking about, I mean, he was following that, he was asking the same question I was. And approaching it different ways, but part of what he came up with, he came up with the unself-conscious design process. It was a phrase that he came up with, and he was looking at the villages in Greece and Italy that have grown really, really slowly over many, many generations. And what he noticed there was that there were no architects involved. There were no city planners involved. It was the people living there creating their physical environment, their town, their village environment. And they did it bit by bit so slowly that
just
they
like
were
the
really...
Fibonacci curve in a way.
That they what?
Like, kind of like the Fibonacci curve in a way. It's
yeah,
what's,
it was,
what's
it was
already
incredible.
There relative to what's already there. You do the next step.
You do the next step, and you can adjust. So I'm sure there were buildings or walls or streets that were torn down, replaced, or whatever, because they put them in, and then they realized, oh, we don't really want to walk this way. You know, it reminds me of when I was in college, and they would put up a new building, and then they'd have to put in new sidewalks to the new building, you know, so they'd tear up this area. Nobody'd be using it for a time while it was being under construction. And then they'd take the fences down, everybody could walk again, and they would put in all these sidewalks, pave all these sidewalks for where they thought people would walk. And pretty soon you see all these dirt paths where the grass has died because people are walking in the places that make sense to them. Well, that's what the unselfconscious design process is like. You are tuned into the place, you're all connected with each other, and you just do, you're following common sense, and you do what feels right, and then you correct it if you find that didn't work. And we don't do that. But what, you know, Alexander was not really a metaphysician, you know, so I took what that's about as far as he took the process. Well, and then he developed the pattern language for design out of that, which really gave a great tool for people to follow universal principles of creating environments. But where I went next was sort of the metaphysical side to that, and you know, and realizing that by doing things with slow incremental growth, I think they were able to tune into universal principles. You know, the common sense is basically inner knowing that has developed over a long time period and found to be useful and true, you know. So you know, I think a lot of this, I think, you know, we can start with the intention of creating harmony in our physical environments, and the way to get there is to set up an environment that you fall in love with and you really feel connected to it, and then you're going to take care of that environment. And then everybody else, you know, is going to come into that consciousness field and feel the desire to also take care of it. You know, I had that experience, you know, in those little villages where there was no chewing gum wrappers on the ground. You know, you better believe I made sure that I started picking up anything that I saw, or you know, make sure you put anything into my pocket.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about, in my classes, I talk about the harmonic structure of sound being a mathematical multiples. And that's, in most sounds, you have these mathematical multiples, which is 1 times, 2 times, 3 times, and so forth. And they say that the distance between the planets is based on this structure, the distance of the electron shells around the nucleus of an atom. Some people say even the weight of each vertebrae in your back. They say that it's at the quantum level as far as energy jumping from one level to another. And Fabian Mamon even says it's the mathematical structure of the frequency of the auras. And then there's also the Fibonacci curve, which is like nature's way of, that's what I learned from your class. It's like, I think of it as nature's way of doing the golden mean. Trying to get to the golden mean, right?
Yeah.
And the Fibonacci is like the spiral of the conch shell, and it's in all life. And I started wondering about the relationship on a cosmic level of the harmonic structure of sound versus the Fibonacci curve. And I started talking with some people about the harmonic structure being the structure of the universe, whereas the Fibonacci curve is kind of like life, and especially the interesting fact is that the Fibonacci curve shows up when you're transmitting love in the physical heart. Your heart goes into the S curve of up and down tempo that has the Fibonacci in it, and some say the harmonics are actually in golden mean ratios when you're transmitting love. So I started thinking of the structure of the harmonic structure and the life energy of almost like a masculine feminine type thing. Any thoughts on this?
Oh, that's a deep one. let's go back to, you know, sort of basic universal principle here, the Fibonacci sequence. Yeah, I would agree. It's nature's way of following the golden ratio, because nature can't divide a circle by 5.5. It can only use whole numbers.
Uh-huh.
And so that Fibonacci, you know, if listeners are not familiar with it, it's a sequence of numbers that goes 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, et cetera. Each number added, adding the previous number to it gives you the next number, and then all of those steps turn out to be approximately the golden ratio. And as you get further and further along, you get up to something like 55 or 54 by 89 or 88, somewhere in there, you know, you really are right on the beam of the golden ratio. So what is the golden ratio? Well, the golden ratio is the ancients call it the principle of organic growth or reproduction in an endless series, which is why in the class I talk about why that's the only choice for the proportioning of the DNA is the golden ratio, because if it is the principle of reproduction in an endless series, well, then that proportion, that vibration has to be there in DNA if DNA is going to serve as the thing that transmits, you know, the information, the codes to the next generation. You know, it's like that's just what makes sense. You know, I mean, that's one of those, it couldn't be any other way. So if the golden ratio is the principle of organic growth, then it's, I don't know if I would do the masculine and the feminine, but it's what happens when these universal principles come into the form of organisms, you know, and it's expressed that way, you know. When the divine principles come into the mineral kingdom, you know, it's being expressed by the platonic solids, you know, by pure geometry and the angles and the how many surfaces you have, you know, and all of that. So each aspect of the creation is more suited for a different set of harmonic laws, so to speak. You know, and it's like this often comes up in the class, because I'm saying, well, the musical harmonics, these simple whole number ratios of 1 to 2 for the octave and 2 to 3 for the perfect fifth, and et cetera, that's one set. But then we also have the root harmonies, which are these relationships and geometrical grids created out of the square root of 2 and the square root of 3 and the square root of 5 and the golden ratio, and that's basically the geometry that is there in the mineral kingdom with that forms squares and triangles and pentagons and hexagons, you know. And so life, you can think of it this way, that life has lots of different choices for which set of harmonic principles or laws to follow. And the organic life, you know, the living substances mostly use the golden ratio, and the minerals are mostly using the root harmonies, and some of the and fluid dynamics, you know, there's golden ratio and root 2 ratios and stuff involved. The way a mushroom cap grows is a root 2 spiral. You know, it's not a golden ratio.
Would you say that the harmonic structure of sound is just another way that the universe has of forming structures as well?
Exactly. Uh-huh. But we still come back to that there is this unity to things and a very small set of principles that show up over and over again in how everything here is created and behaves.
You know, it's interesting. I often think of the ultimate goal as a person for me is to be still inside perfect harmony. I think of that as perfect harmony inside, and totally flowing and moving and adjusting and inflexible on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting, because a lot of people think of geometry as something that's really stagnant. Really, I mean, they think of it that way, but there's a whole a flow to it. Just like in music, they say if you've got a perfect rhythm, like a drum machine. It's actually not as healthy as a rhythm that's actually breathing and going in and out of the rhythm.
Right. And it's also boring.
I
really can notice it when I'm hearing music that has a synthetic rhythm, a drum machine or something, because I tune out. I stop listening to the drum after a while. It's just not interesting anymore.
Right. Which can be good, because that can allow you to go deeper into other aspects.
Well, even when I was doing, I've had a bunch of different brushes with sound healing. And in the 70s, I was really into learning a lot of shamanic practices. And I had this wonderful big talus drum. It was a double-headed, two skins. And you just, I just beat on one skin, but it resonated the other skin at an overtone of the first one. And then I could lead a group of hundreds of people outside and they would be able to hear my guidance on a inner journey, a trance journey sort of thing, if I pitched my voice in that overtone. And the drum would amplify my voice, and it would be like a little speaker system.
Cool.
And, but through those experiences, I started to, when you're drumming that, you make it, one of the secrets of that kind of drumming is that you start with your heartbeat, and then you do multiples of the heartbeat for the rhythm that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your heartbeat changes, because you get more relaxed or you get excited or something, the drumming is going to change. But it's imperceptible. You try to keep a steady drumming so that people go in trance. But even then, I know that if we had a metronome next to me, I wouldn't have been, on a precise, mechanical, perfect rhythm. There would have been fluctuation in that.
So what is the essence of flow? How does flow, which is the essence of music, the quality, I always think of the quality of the flow in music and in the human body, the amount of flow you have going is the quality of health you have. Because if you're not flowing, whether it's muscles or energy at all different levels, then you're not healthy. So what in sacred geometry, how does flow manifest?
Oh, that's interesting.
Not your normal questions here, huh?
Yeah, I like this. Well, the first thing that comes up is the class I just taught online, which was the one for the second semester on that I call Architectural and Musical Harmonies. And there is, in architecture, we get to use... it's one of the few places where you can use all of those different proportional systems. So we traditionally, timeless architecture, sacred architecture, use the root harmonies to make root rectangles and to make grids, like the octagonal grid is a root 2 grid, and you could lay out whole Islamic mosques or whole temples with that. And there were other grids that were sort of based on, like, the tic-tac-toe board that used in India. So the root harmonies was available to us, but the musical harmonies are also, the whole number ratios are also available to us, And so there's this huge deck of cards or this huge palette that we have to choose from. And in the class I was just teaching, we started by looking at the musical harmonies, and I was showing them drawings and pictures of buildings, the floor plans and the facades, the sides of the buildings, and showing them how to see those musical proportions in the windows and in the facades and the doorways and all this kind of stuff. So there'd be a doorway or a window that was proportioned 1 to 2, and another one was 2 to 3, and another one was 4 to 7, and et cetera, all these... musical whole number ratios and stuff. But then once we kind of got that idea that you know, architecture really is frozen music. That's not a metaphor. That's an actual statement, a fact, that there's all this vibration in the building. So the way, you know, in the ancient and timeless sort of metaphysical spiritual approach to architecture, you thought of the building as a vibration and able to affect the vibration of the people that are in the housed or sheltered in those spaces as well. But the other thing I was showing was how there's rhythm. All the terms that we have in music theory apply to this older tradition of architecture, where we talk about consonants and things being in accord and cohesion and themes in music, where there's themes in buildings, a primary and a secondary theme. There's variation on themes, and there's rhythmic flow is one of the concepts. And in that, you could have a colonnade, for instance, around a courtyard of a public plaza, and you know, you could have, there'd be like, often the columns are spaced evenly at the courtyard level, but then as the building goes up, the second floor might be a different rhythm. It might divide the space of the columns on the first floor in half or in thirds and have a different rhythm going on there. You know, so it's sort of like multi-rhythmic drumming to be in that space if you convert what you're seeing in the visuals, you know, the architectural structure that you see visually, and converting that to rhythm and music, frozen music, you know, there's a rhythm going on in there. And then there are places like where you go up stairways, or there's places where the spacing might change, and it often goes with areas where the building is saying it's appropriate to speed up or slow down. Uh-huh. So the rhythm that's in the building is telling you. Libraries, the old Carnegie libraries, particularly in New England, which were all designed with sacred geometry, by H.H. Richardson and his followers from Boston, and a lot of those buildings are just, they're exquisite. And there are all these subtle hints to have you slow down as you approach the entrance. And then come to a standstill. Those old buildings, you came through the door, and then there was a large foyer space that was often a square or an octagon or had a dome over it or something. And those, in sacred architecture, sacred geometry, the square is all about groundedness and stillness and the landing pad, the grounding place. And that when you shape the building that way, then it influences the people to behave in that way that you're wanting them to, so they just kind of slow down, take breath, which you also need because the light level is lower in libraries, so that the books don't fade. But it also works to slow you down.
Nice.
And get very still and quiet. So there's lots of a flow, and of course, feng shui is all about flow.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that is about how do you set up the spaces so that the way that you walk through it is in a very smooth kind of meander, and there's no, you know, of course, we violate this all over the place in Western construction.
Uh-huh.
If we are walking forwards, and there's what feng shui calls a blocking wall, and you have to move 90 degrees to the left, which is not an innate human movement. You know, humans are built to move in arcs and curves and meanders and snake building, you know. That's what I love about Venice. Going to Venice is a training course. I went there when I was in architecture school, and I was just astounded the fluidity of those spaces. And it's rectilinear buildings, you know. They still had hard-edged, right angles, 90-degree angle buildings, but the way that they put them together and the way they put the walkways through the space, it was just incredible. It was a study in fluid dynamics.
You know, it occurs to me do you read the book by Hermann Hesse where he, it's, the whole story is about somebody that creates gardens and sacred geometry structures with, in alignment with the music, and it's like one big harmony. Did you ever read that book? No.
No.
Oh, well, it occurs to me to take this to the next level. Do you know of any places on the planet that meld the music that has, it's almost like a musical, maybe an artistic building that has the music synchronized with the actual geometry?
Yeah, one example is Gothic cathedrals, and actually there's two things. You're reminding me of something else I wanted to point out here. But in the Gothic cathedrals, I had a friend once who was singing Gregorian chant, and he told me that in Gregorian chant and all plain chant, there's a formula for which intervals musically you can put and which one follows that. If you go up a fifth, then you are, you know, you can't just go anywhere. You have to go a prescribed step next. And this was because all those sounds were going to be held so long in that resonant cavity of the cathedral that they were all going to merge with each other. And so you had to make sure that you had these very clear harmonies in the whole melody line. Well, the other thing he told me was that you can't just take the chant that was created in one cathedral and go sing it in another. Those were originally done with an awareness of the resonant frequency of that space.
Oh, cool.
Isn't that cool. Amazing?
Yeah, it's cool.
You know, and the same with the Egyptian temples, and so that's a whole nother line of inquiry. And it's one of the things that got me into sound healing, of chanting in Stone Age temples in the British Isles and Western Europe, and finding the resonant frequency. And then there was this astounding experience I had once in France, where after 2 weeks of experimenting, I was starting to get the hang of it, and found a resonant frequency and started chanting it. And my travel partner did another, I think maybe an octave or perfect fifth or something. We did that for a number of minutes. And when we stopped, we heard an overtone that the chamber itself was feeding back to us. And there's University of Princeton's doing a whole bunch of research on this now. But so it is possible to activate these chambers because they were done with so much sacred geometry and awareness of the relationship between the architectural proportions and the ratios in music that you can go back and forth. You can get the space to sing by feeding it the correct frequency.
Nice.
Or sets of frequencies or intervals.
You know, one thing I talk about that we can end with is, as I talk about the essence of sound healing is to bring you to a consistent frequency of harmony, which is the home note. And that consistency is the peace. And I often think of the consistency in sacred geometry, I often think of the Fibonacci, because consistency can't be more consistent than basing what you're going to do next on the exact thing before, which is also when you've got perfect logical thought connected to source, that seems to be the same type of pattern that I often see in the way you teach as well, where one thing is connected and people can follow really easily. And that is a whole state of peace,
right?
Which is
so we
really
come back
about.
To, you know, in the stillness, in that quiet place, you have the opportunity. The door opens for you to connect with the mind of the One and delve into and understand the universal principles that all of this world is created from, and that is an act of love. Like I was talking about, you make a connection deep enough, you're going to care about the other people, you're going to care about nature, you're going to care about the planet, you're going to care about your block, your neighborhood, your home, your body as a temple, you know.
Thanks so much for being on, and we can take this energy of harmony into the weekend, months ahead, years ahead, and lifetimes ahead. Thanks so much.